of that. Anyway, it is now 12 o'clock. In fact, it's 12:01, and it is time. The animals are getting restive, and it's time to get things rolling here. So let's see what happens. We'll open the floodgates and get things rolling here. It's time for Animal Voices.
Yes, and welcome to Animal Voices. Every creature deserves to live a life in that promised Garden of Eden. The chickens, the turkeys, the pigs, and cows. All of them have a right to live their lives free from cruelty, from the harsh conditions that the factory farming imposes on these wonderful members of the animal kingdom. In this program, Animal Voices, we envision a world where the human race will finally make peace with the animal kingdom. We envision a world where human beings will no longer kill, maim, torture, and exploit fellow beings. Yes, fellow beings, for food or any other purpose. Yes, we also recognize that animals have fundamental rights, and that these rights include that they be treated with compassion and mercy. Well, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver, affectionately known as Co-op Radio. So Animal Voices is pleased to, is our technician today is Alan Jensen. My name is Carl Loskin. Marge Adams and John Pranger, they're not with us today. Shortly, we will be speaking with Rob Wilson from Salt Spring Island, and he is working on a broad-based group of environmental and labor organizations that are opposing some legislation that's been passed at in the BC government. Then we will hear from Alan Jensen, who is going on a trip to Peru. And then at the halfway mark, we will hear from Larry Evans from Missoula in Montana, who is a mushroom educator. And we will be hearing about flying squirrels, jumping reindeer, and whether animals eat mushrooms. Well, we have Rob Wilson on the line. And as we said before, he is working with a broad-based group of environmental organizations that are opposing the recently passed Soil Amendment Code of Practice. Well, welcome to Animal Voices, Rob.
Thank you.
Yes, and maybe you can just tell us what is this legislation that was so clandestinely, maybe we think it's clandestinely, slipped through the legislative process.
Okay, well, the Soil Amendment Code of Practice was signed by the minister back in June of this year, came into effect in September of this year, and what the point of the Code of Practice is to facilitate the land spreading of domestic sewage sludge and pulp mill sludge and a variety of other industrial toxins on agricultural land, on forest land, crown lands, including watershed lands, as a soil amendment.
So I'm so pleased you're opposing this because, you know, there's been very little written about this. And to my mind, it is so absolutely disastrous because toxic sludge, there is a book called Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Lies, Damn Lies, and the Public Relations Industry. So how do you react when you as an environmental person, came across this legislation being passed? What was your reaction?
It's interesting that you bring up that book, actually, because that book was primarily about the public relations industry and its various spins, and they use that title, and it sort of highlights in one of the chapters of that book how the PR industry has sort of rebranded sludge into something that is good for you. They call it fertilizer. They call it soil amendment. And so it was something that was happening in the United States, and it's sort of taken hold across North America and Europe. So it has it has been done. It's not new. There's a range of incidences where they have land spread pulp mill sludge, and this is really about pulp mill sludge. That was the driver for this particular code, although it can be mixed with domestic sewage sludge. And there was, like I said, some other industrial sources that are named in it, including fly ash and water treatment sludge.
Maybe, Rob, you can gross us out by mentioning some of the kind of stuff that's included in toxic sludge that they want to spread on our agricultural food, on our agricultural land.
Yeah, I mean, a pulp mill sludge is basically the after they put the water that goes through the processes when they're making pulp in a pulp mill, and it goes through all of the processes that is meant to clean the effluent before it gets pumped back out into the environment, and what they have left is the pulp mill sludge. And so, as you can imagine, that is chock full of all of the toxins that were in the industrial processes to make pulp. So we know some things. We know that there's a variety of chlorinated and non-chlorinated organic benzenes and phenolics. We know that there's a lot of heavy metals. There is also, in the only analysis that we have of pulp mill sludge, is this huge unresolvable hump of toxic chemicals, which actually has no known toxicology. So there's even at least as alarming as what we do know about the toxins that are in it is what we don't know.
Now, you say this is basically because of the pulp mill lobby, but have you any idea what the intention is there, where all the sludge will go to?
Well, the code allows for it on agricultural land, including pasture lands, food growing lands, and within the crown forest lands, including watersheds. So, I mean, that basically covers it, doesn't it?
Right.
So even though there is some allowance for saying that when it's spread on land that it won't be used for pasture land, it won't be used for growing food crops for a certain number of months given various different conditions, we also know that a lot of the chemicals that are involved in pulp mill sludge are persistent organic pollutants, and they're persistent, which means that they don't go away. Further, regardless of how long they actually wait until they grow food or put cows out to pasture, there is a large dependence on all of this land for wildlife, which, of course, doesn't read signs and is not at all subject to any of these restrictions.
So now, if these heavy metals, all kinds of, even if they spread it over the crown lands, you say it's going into the deer, but it eventually ends up into our rivers, into our water and fish, and contaminates. I mean, it's absolutely insidious and pervasive. I mean,
it absolutely does end up back on our dinner plates. There's no question about that.
I mean, like in Vancouver, they only have a primary sewage treatment process here. So maybe you can just run us through about primary process and then what is slipping by. I mean, I know that the people women having taken birth control pills, that the estrogens were being consumed by fish, and it was doing all kinds of stuff to them, like increasing the number of eggs that the female fish laid so that they were infertile, and it made male fish produce eggs. I mean, let's go on from here.
Well, I mean, the thing about sewage sludge is that sewage is not just what gets flushed down the toilet. Of course, there's no separation between your urban industrial and residential, and hospitals and everything else. So the sewage, and of course there's no way to say that there's any particular thing in sewage, well, except for the obvious, at any one time, but we know that it can contain PCBs, it can contain, as you say, a lot of pharmaceuticals and endocrine disrupting chemicals.
Right.
And there's, solvents, paints, oil, all manner of oil-based chemicals end up in the sewers, and they're going to end up in the sludge as well.
Now, Rob, you mentioned that the lumber, and this was basically forwarded by the promoted by the lumber industry, and how does one go about? Were there vigorous lobby groups? Do you suggest? Do you know anything about that? And how do we go about opposing this?
Well, I think as far as where the lobby came from, I mean, the pulp mill industry. I don't know how generically you can characterize the pulp mill industry, because a lot of the pulp mills say that they actually have no intention of doing this. They have their own processes that are set up for handling their sludge, and they're not going to do it. There's some mills that do it. So where the lobby push comes from may not be from some industry association, and it's difficult to say that for sure. But in terms of opposition to it, I think that what's important is to let the government know through the Ministry of Environment that this is just simply not acceptable for all the good reasons. There is all of the local agricultural organizations that people can contact and help to galvanize some opposition to letting that happen in their area. There's also some opportunities for people to approach their municipalities and talk about passing some local resolutions that will address this issue, because the land spreading from a pulp mill sludge doesn't necessarily happen next door to the pulp mill or even within that region. What this code of practice does is allow it to happen anywhere in the province. So from any particular pulp mill, it could end up anywhere in the province.
Now, you live on Salt Spring Island, and of course there's been a lot of controversy with the Crofton Mill there. What do you know about that?
The Crofton Mill is actually one of the ones that says that they actually have no intention of doing any land spreading with their sludge. The sludge is a problem in any case. I mean, what happens in most of the mills is that they incinerate the sludge in their boilers. Now, given the toxicology of pulp mill sludge, it's not necessarily a good thing to burn it in the boilers and have the toxins spewed into the air. So whether they're spewed out into the air or land spread directly onto agricultural land, the point is that there should be no opportunity for release of those kinds of industrial toxins into the environment.
Now, Rob, we're not going to do away with pulp mills, so your incineration is not an option, not very viable, but probably better than spreading it over the land. So what do you suggest?
Well, there has been a lot of work done, and there has been studies done on what different options are for disposal of sludge. And the anaerobic digestion of pulp mill sludge is actually a feasible option, and what that does is get rid of, I won't say all, but it will remove a huge swath of the toxins that are present in it, and what it does is reduce the amount of matter considerably. So there are some options, there has been research done, and I think that what we would like to see is more work done on clean production in the first place,
right?
And to further investigate some options for the anaerobic digestion of sludge and the safe disposal and containment of toxins.
Now, I didn't quite understand this alternative that you mentioned there. Are you referring to microbial solutions to this the sludge? Maybe you can just repeat that.
The anaerobic digestion of sludge is yes, it's basically a way of composting in a more complex manner, so that anaerobic meaning that there is not oxygen present when it's doing it. So they put it in a vessel, and there's the processing that happens will address a lot of the toxins in it.
Now, Rob, I wonder if you could just sort of, in closing, just briefly tell us the problem again, and then what we can do, like the municipalities. Just run over that to imprint it on our listeners, because we do have listeners out in Chemainus area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I guess the point is that the Soil Amendment Code of Practice is allowing for the widespread release of industrial toxins, and not just from pulp mills, but that's primarily, as I say, the driver, into the environment. And that if people want to react to this, then they should be contacting the Ministry of Environment directly on a provincial level. They can talk to their municipalities, and they can talk to their local growers and agricultural organizations.
Are there any good web pages for reference?
We have all of our material up on our own website. That's www.croftonair.org. And there's also a sample letter with a mechanism to send a letter to the minister on that website.
All right, let's just go over that. Croftonair.org.
That's right.
CROFTONair.org.
That's right.
And you get some information to write to your municipalities, make a presentation. Well, Rob, we're greatly indebted for you to coming on to Animal Voices. We know so well from Animal Voices that land is our life. Land is our physical life and our food and our sustenance. Thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And Alan, yeah. Alan Jensen, our technician, and I call him Mr. Co-op Radio. He is so dedicated in making things work here, volunteered for decades from its originals, Co-op Radio. But he also has a career with many varied interests. And maybe you can tell us a bit about your interests in... just escapes my mind now. Out at UBC, what's it called?
Oh, I spent years studying anthropology at university. That was a while ago, some years ago, before I ended up at Co-op Radio. I guess from an early age, I had an interest in global issues and global politics. It goes back to when I was really very young, like in elementary school, and in anthropology and things around anthropology, archaeology, that sort of, but in other cultures and other parts of the world. So when I got to university, I ended up, I did a lot of different things at university because I had a lot of interests, but ultimately, I ended up getting my degree in anthropology, then went into grad school and did graduate work in anthropology as well.
And then I mean, you're middle-aged now.
Yes.
So, and you've spent decades volunteering all over. You have a great interest in birds, Animal Voices, of course, making Co-op Radio viable.
After I eventually finished grad school, I ended up working for the government for a while, for the federal government. That's a long story, and I won't get into it. But I didn't really enjoy working for the federal government very much. There's all kinds of reasons why. Most people who have spent years working for the federal government might have some idea why. You wouldn't necessarily want to spend many, many years there. So at one point, I just sort of quit and decided, well, what happens. And so I ended up, I knew about Co-op Radio, so I ended up coming down here to an orientation. And the orientation still happened on the third Tuesday of the month at 6 o'clock, and anybody can show up. You just show up here on the third Tuesday at 6 o'clock. And this is a long time ago. This is well over 20 years ago now. And I thought it was interesting, so I came, I took a little course, a little radio production course that was being offered at the time, and I ended up starting to volunteer on the Rational program, a public affairs show, which is my first interest. So I've ended up spending much more time being a music programmer here than a public affairs, but my real interest is in public affairs, politics and public affairs. And So anyway, I ended up volunteering at the Rational, and I was unemployed. I was collecting unemployment insurance, so it was easy at the time. I had a year off, a free year, right? And in those days, anyway, UI didn't bother you too much. And so I was able to spend a lot of time at Co-op Radio, learning Co-op Radio, learning the technical side as well as programming, learning about radio production, because though I was an avid radio person, only since I was a little kid, right? I always have my ears stuck to a radio, but I'd never been around a radio station before, so I had a lot to learn, and I was lucky to have that time to dive into radio and learn about radio. And the more I was here, the more I liked it, and the more I realized this is where I should be. And it satisfied a lot of my interests in terms of cultural things and political things and all kinds of interests I had for a long time. So for somebody who was a student of anthropology, this place is an anthropological study in itself, right? It's a very, very interesting organization. It's a big happening place, and even 20, 25 years ago it was, and it still is, fascinating place to be. I was a nice place to immerse myself in. So eventually, to make a long story short, I ended up being a staff person there for many years. I was program coordinator as well as doing programming. I've always done programming, both music and public affairs and arts too. I'm interested in the arts too, so I've done a lot of arts programming as well as the political and music. But these days I'm here doing this show once a week, and I do specials in fundraising time, but mainly I do music shows these days.
And now you'll be off to Peru this coming week. You're a world traveler.
Yeah, I've always, part of my interest in anthropology and other cultures has always been an interest in other parts of the world, and going to other parts of the world as well as, and seeing the people there, then the places there, and the flora and fauna as well as the, you know, human culture. And so I've done a fair bit of traveling over the years, just sort of rambling around different parts of the globe. It's something, there's nothing I'd rather do than go and just sort of be in other places and throw myself into totally foreign situations. And sometimes it's challenging, but it's always very rewarding for me. For some people, it's not the thing. For some people, would just rather be here and do their things in the city, and that's fine. I'm just as happy being out there somewhere, whether it's, you know, in the wilds of Peru or it's, you know, in Central Africa and the Sahara Desert or in India or wherever. So I've done a fair bit of that over the years, and it all kind of connects in terms of the interests I've always had.
Now, what will you be doing in Peru this time? Surely you've probably been to Machu Picchu and done those touristy things there. Coca Canyon, is it?
Yeah, I have been to some of those places. I won't get into all the details, but the trip is more complicated than that. In fact, as soon as we hit Peru, we're going to head south into Chile, and so we're only being in Peru a couple of days. It's a matter of it's cheap to fly to Lima, and then head south and take a bus straight, an 18-hour bus ride down there south, and you're in Chile, and then. Then poke around Chile for a couple of weeks, and then you can go up and over the Andes into northern Argentina from Chile, into northwestern Argentina. And so we'll spend a couple of weeks there and then go north into Bolivia from northern Argentina and spend some time there. And then eventually there's a road from La Paz, Bolivia, back down to Chile. So back up and over the Andes. There's a different road. There's one road that goes up to Argentina, and then there's another road that goes down to from Bolivia to Chile. And so we'll end up doing that and then back up to Peru. So all this is going to take about 6 weeks. But all the details aren't fixed. I mean, we don't have, other than a reservation for a hotel the first night when we hit Lima, who knows what's going to happen exactly. This is the rough idea, but it's all pretty organic.
Now, you were on the Rational, which was basically a political program and observing. So maybe you can just tell us a little bit about the influences of political aspects of Bolivia and Peru. And, of course, there was a change of government in Argentina this past week.
A sort of a change. I mean, it's not much. I mean, it is a change, but nonetheless, it's a different person. But if you follow it at all, you know, it's the wife of the previous president. They They are very close politically. They have been in the same party for decades, and there isn't going to be much of a change. I mean, there are economic problems in Argentina. It's a country of great rises and falls, and the economy seems to have collapsed quite rapidly. Right now, they're doing pretty good in Argentina. But 6 years ago, it was a complete basket case. It was huge unemployment. Inflation was rampant. It was a terrible mess economically. And the Kirchner, who just left being president for the last 4 years, has presided over a growing economy. And things are really booming in Argentina. The question is, will it get too hot and burn out again, like has happened more than once before? We'll see. Though all of the countries, so there's a woman president in Argentina now, and in Chile there's also a woman president, which is very interesting. And Chile's been doing quite well recently too, and both countries have really been challenging the political establishment of the past. Both countries have decided they're going to put the generals on trial who led the dirty wars of the 70s and early 80s down there. And there's a lot of interesting stuff going on, as is happening in Spain right now, too, but we won't get into that. But it's a similar sort of thing happening, and it's going to be interesting to see how things unfold. Also, in Bolivia, there's been a great change politically, as Evo Morales has taken over a couple of years ago, and he's the first native indigenous person ever to become president of Bolivia, and he's bringing in sweeping changes. It's just night and day, the differences between him and who has previously been running the show. Now, our next guest is on the phone, and as I'm operating, I'm going to have to answer the phone, so okay. I'm going to put, you talk.
Okay, well, I'm really interested also in the aspect that the Andes are the headwaters for the mighty Amazon River. And with global warming, certainly is global warming, which is affecting the Antarctic, the Arctic, and all the mountain ranges, the glaciers are melting. It's going to be a tremendous time of challenge for the people in Peru who depend on the melting ice from the glaciers for their agricultural crops. So that's a challenge which is facing directly, that there is going to be a worldwide shortage of water in many areas. So, we have our special guest on the line. We have Larry Evans, who is a mushroom educator, and he will be, among other things, telling us about, look forward to this, flying squirrels, jumping reindeer, and whether wild animals eat mushrooms. Welcome to Animal Voices, Larry Evans.
Hello, Carl.
Yes, good to hear from you, and thank you for calling. Well, you know, fungi and, of course, mushrooms, let's start off with, you mentioned that they were some of the oldest life forms, even before animals, and that's quite amazing.
Yeah, they are, Carl. Fungi, probably more primitive life forms than either plants or animals, and they actually resemble animals more than plants in their terms of their biochemistry. They have all the same 10 essential amino acids that animals need. And, they tend to respire. They live like we do, like by eating things and breaking them down.
Now, I wanted to mention that you're calling from Missoula in Montana. Now, the fungi that will be growing over there, are they similar in many ways or very different to what we would have on the coast here?
There are some similarities and some differences. For example, we get the same Clytophobe, little smelly anise Clytophobe, Clytophobe odora, out here that you guys get on the coast. It's a little different. Then we also have a lot of mushrooms that are more dry site adapted, things like puffballs and stuff.
Now, yes, those puffballs, some of them are edible, of course. So now.
And truffles.
They what?
And truffles. We have lots of truffles in Montana as well as you have there.
Wow.
In fact, truffles are a really important food source for a lot of squirrels and other small mammals. They dig them up and eat them, and they then when the the mushroom passes through their digestion system, they the spores germinate in the fecal pellets that the little squirrels and rodents leave behind.
Now, there's a relationship between the squirrels, the fungus, and the trees and everything that grows here. Is that correct?
You know, John Muir once said that when we tug on a little piece of nature, we find it's connected to everything else. And I think that's especially true with fungi. When we look at the fungi that are fruiting around here, we notice that the truffles come up during the exact time of the year when there's no more available food for the rodents. For example, around here it's early July. Things have dried up, the buds are hardened off, the leaves and shoots are out, and yet there's no ripe fruit yet. And at that precise window, we have a number of edible truffles that make themselves available.
Now, is this the truffles that are so highly priced and prized for their delicate flavor?
This is, truffles in general are fungi or mushrooms that live underground. In that group, there is what we call the true and the false truffles, and the true truffles, or the genus tuber, are, yes, very expensive and highly sought after, and they are widely believed to have chemicals or substances inside the mushroom that imitate the mammal sex pheromone.
Right. Now, these truffles, would they only grow under particular trees, like an oak tree? Or would they be under different varieties of species of trees?
There are a number of different tree and truffle associations, and many of them are exclusive. For example, the French Perigot truffle will grow with oak and with filbert or hazelnut.
Right.
Whereas the Oregon white truffle tends to grow with Douglas fir, but a lot of other things grow with Douglas fir as well.
Now, this is the issue that you've been raising here. Do wild animals eat mushrooms? But yes, many people have this idea that mushrooms will destroy your liver. So, and of course, there's a general, many people fear mushrooms and won't eat the good ones. So how do these animals know which ones to eat and what happens to them if they eat the wrong one?
Well, there's a number of differences, too. People often think that if an animal eats it, so can I, but that's really not true, especially when you think of a squirrel. A squirrel's kidneys, relative to the size of his body, are much larger and much more efficient than a human kidney. Because the squirrel's moving a very small volume of fluid, he can stand a dose of poison five times as much as a human, and it won't affect his metabolism badly.
So there's lots of mythology about mushrooms, but what about squirrels and bears? I mean, all of this,
there are so many bear mushrooms that are eaten by bears. I've been working with graduate students and Dr. Chuck Jonkel, who does work with bears, and we've identified about a dozen species of mushroom that bears eat, and we've also described something that is perhaps a slime mold that bears dig out from logs that has a very strong pheromonal type of smell, a musky smell.
Right. Now, these mushrooms often have medicinal qualities. Why would these have this? What do you ascribe that to?
Well, you know, basically everything has a fungus, Carl. Everything that is put together has a way to be taken apart, and fungi have the complete toolkit for taking things apart. They can take apart everything from dioxin, chlorinated biphenyls, tremendously toxic chemicals that humans have made, and they have the ability to literally digest these and turn them into their elemental components.
And that's how when these, like a log, a tree falls down, they're broken down first of all by the fungi, and then they can be assimilated by the tree as a nutrient.
It's true. The fungi can either break down the lignin, where we call it a white rot, or it can break down the cellulose and leave the lignin, in which case it's a brown cuboidal rot. And the brown cuboidal rot has a tremendous ability for storing water. And in the more arid parts of the northern Rockies, that's very important because we get months sometimes without enough moisture. And the main reservoir of soil moisture is in that decomposing wood and fungus-infested material.
Now, when I mentioned that I'm interested in mushrooms, we'll talk about how people can become interested in, maybe even grow some. That's not all that difficult, is it, Larry? But people always ask me about, we'll use the technical word, psilocybe. Mm-hmm. And now, maybe you can give us some characteristics of what is commonly known as magic mushrooms.
Well, magic mushrooms, we have in North America about 45 maybe species in the temperate part of North America, and probably around that many in the south and tropical areas. Right now, the way that identification is organized, not all members of the genus psilocybe or psilocybe are hallucinogenic. Only those that have the blue staining capacity.
So
they all grow on manured lands, and they're also cellulose decomposers.
So on one of our islands here, there's a farmer, Gabriola Island, of course, where the farmer will, during the fall, charge people eager. He has a cow pastures there. So will these magic mushrooms only grow in cow pastures? And he has a little bit of pocket money there, collecting from people.
You know, it's quite possible to enhance the productivity of these mushrooms. I know that one of the old tricks was to spread a mixture of horse manure and wood chips out on the pastures.
Right.
And this tended to, favor one particular type of mushroom over another.
Right. Many people know about the Amanita. Of course, that's the famous red mushroom with the it's red with the, or orange with the white spots on top. So
right. That's the fly agaric, as it's called too. And it's have you ever wondered why Santa Claus had such a ridiculously colored costume?
Tell us.
Father Christmas has his little red and white outfit on.
Yeah, and do the reindeer eat that?
Yes, in fact, the whole Santa Claus and his flying reindeer mythology kind of arises from the way that people discovered this mushroom, which was that caribou and reindeer would eat this mushroom and cavort, I think is the right word. But if you've seen these animals cavort, they hunch their back, they lock their legs, and they literally jump 10 or 12 feet in the air. You know, it's amazing. And I can imagine the first time you'd see that would pretty much open your eyes. It would be pretty shocking to see an animal like that jumping literally for joy, I suppose.
Now Santa will have to take care of the Amanitas there and wherever in North Pole, make sure that Santa and the reindeer can travel greater distance than just cavorting 15 feet.
Well, the thing about the Amanita that is very interesting, I think, Carl, is that it's being used in a number of countries now to treat chronic drug addiction like cocaine and heroin addiction. Just one 12 or 24-hour trip on this mushroom, the addicted need for these types of substances is completely obliterated.
That's interesting.
They have a very high recovery rate for addictions when they're treated with this type of regimen.
Now, we would like to remind our listeners we're talking with Larry Evans from Missoula in Montana, and you have a wonderful web page. It's called fungaljungle.org, jungle, J-U-N-G-A-L. So,
Jungle,
right. Well, sorry, fungal jungle. So now you've done some songs, and you're quite the character there. I mean, you're what they call a mycologist.
And, yeah, and I love to educate people about mushrooms, too. It gives me a big kick. And so I've written a bunch of songs, and fortunately in my other life I was a restaurant owner for a while, and I got to connect with a whole great, big, beautiful community of musicians out here in Montana. And they've been good enough to help me put this thing together a couple times now.
How would you say, if somebody was interested in this, the mushrooms, and of course it's tied together with so much mythology because they grow in the dark, they don't have any photosynthesis, and they suddenly appear in the morning, you see the mushrooms there. So how would you go about educating somebody, you know, and taking away fear?
Well, basically, we need to think that the mushrooms that we're seeing are just the sexual apparatus of organisms that are usually much bigger. That what we see as a little mushroom, we're actually walking on the back of an organism when we go to pick those mushrooms. And that's just a very small component. Almost half of the protoplasm in our ecosystems, at least half, is dedicated to the underground part of the forest. You've got at least as much life going on underground as you do above ground.
Now, that's why it's important for people, when they're picking mushrooms, to pick some of the varieties you cut off with a knife and some you can pull out.
We know we've found that it doesn't make a lot of difference. It seems to be more along the lines of picking the apples on an apple tree. It really doesn't do, for example, for a mycorrhizal mushroom like a chanterelle, it doesn't seem to have much of an effect. There's a 20-year study now in Oregon that's been going on chanterelle harvest. Has found that there's really not much impact of harvesting on chanterelle production.
So somebody is interested, wants to walk in the forest, get the Audubon book and read it up. And, you know, there's mycological societies all over British Columbia. You're obviously running one in Montana.
Oh, we have great fun.
You have great fun. And
we put the fun into fungi.
The fun guy.
Fun in the fun guy, yes indeed.
So now
that's what we do, and you can sing along too, you know, that's the nice thing.
Right, can you give us a tune there, Larry?
The fun. Sure, let's see.
Give us the
some foliotas are big ones, other ones are small. Some foliotas are good to eat, and others not at all. Hey. C5 foliota, never going to eat it again. C5 foliota, never going to eat it again. That's from the first CD.
Love it, love it. So these CDs are available on your webpage, Funga.
Yeah, you can listen in on them, see if you like it. It's pretty wacky music.
I love it.
People, either they love it or they think I'm totally just nuts. So.
Well, let them think you're nuts, but it's a very... fundamental issue here with the nature, the forests, and the animals, and you're the fungal boogeyman.
Boogie on.
But there's so many aspects, and we still have another 5 minutes or so. Maybe I'll leave it up to you. There's so many aspects of mythology also involved with the mushrooms. Are you familiar with any of that?
Oh, yes. You know, I think most of my commercial interest is with morel mushrooms. They come in after the fire.
Right.
And about, did you know that of all of our ascomycetes in our part of the continent, really, over a quarter of them only fruit after a fire?
Right.
They're so dependent on the fire as a part of their ecology, and I mean a whole ecosystem of insects and human mushroom pickers and everything else comes into the forest specifically for these mushrooms.
Larry, I know of a story. We have an area called the Okanagan here. And at least 15 years ago, they had a fire here about 3 or 4 years ago in Okanagan. But there was about 15 years ago, there was another gigantic fire in the Okanagan that covered an enormous area. And there was a fellow who knew, smart guy like you, he knew that morels grow after the fire. And he was there in the spring. They export these morels to France. And there was a newspaper article that he had made enough money picking morels after the fire that he had bought himself a house. And, of course, he was standing in front of his house. And that that alerted not keen mushroom lookers, but Revenue Canada. And he had to share his mushroom bounty with the good Lord up there. With the mighty powers.
It's pretty remarkable, really, when you think about it, what a tremendous impact mushrooms have on our lives. Every vitamin B that you've ever eaten comes from a mushroom.
Right.
Vitamin B is grown as a yeast in culture, you know, and then extracted from the yeast cells. All of our brewing, all of our breads are dependent on fungi. We really use a lot in our lives. I don't know if you're aware, Carl, that there's over almost 1,300 different species of mushroom are traded commercially worldwide.
Really?
And that there are, you asked about medicinals, there are 450-something medicinal mushrooms that are traded worldwide.
Wow.
One of them that we mentioned in the CDs is the caterpillar fungus.
Right.
The caterpillar fungus growing in the ground. In Tibet, where it is found, sells for $1,000 a pound, so please don't mind me looking around. Yeah.
Thanks.
Just like that. It's an amazing little mushroom that grows on a caterpillar, and it sells for $1,000 a pound, and it supports an entire economy in the eastern part of Tibet for a couple months.
Wow. What does it do to people?
It's what the Chinese women marathon or the Chinese women runners ate a few years ago that made the papers because they were, you know, clocking new records every time they went because they'd been eating this mushroom. This
it goes with high altitude. No pun intended.
I was given it as a cure for altitude sickness, but it definitely made the walls wiggle a little bit.
Now, one of the disasters of what we're doing in British Columbia here is cutting down first growth forests. Is that, many of the fungal species have never been studied or have not even been identified. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. I'm afraid that this is a story that's been repeated in a lot of places. I'm working right now, Carl, in Bolivia, trying to document some of the fungi of the primary rainforest before it's all knocked out. And it's just been getting harder and harder to find this type of undisturbed habitat. I think that this is one of the most important sources for, let's face it, all the things that we've just discovered, the mushrooms that eat dioxins and the mushrooms that break down these poisonous chemicals, all turned out to be old-growth species. If we destroyed all of our old growth before we discovered that, we wouldn't even know that there was a way to break down all these poisons that we've created.
That's exactly what you say in your webpage. You say you are seeking solutions to all kinds of environmental problems and ecological issues. And one of the ways to approach this is through the study of mycelium, mushrooms.
Yeah,
maybe you can just...
How do mushrooms do it? We're using mushrooms for restoration as well by, the mushrooms will actually break down logs and help hold water in the soils, which is a real key thing.
Maybe you can,
as I mentioned earlier.
Maybe you can touch on how mushrooms propagate. How do they...
Yeah, You know, it's interesting, Carl. There's fundamentally two different ways, approaches to reproduction that mushrooms have. One of them is more like the salmon, which is like, you know, we only swim upstream once and then we die. And the other approach is more like humans or other mammals, where we have a litter of pups every year or two as long as we can. And mushrooms are the same way. Mushrooms like the oyster mushroom that grow on a log, or the psilocybe, the psilocybe mushroom that grows on manure, they live in a very small location. And so they put all their energy into growing, and then they go through a fundamental change in their lifestyle, and they suddenly have sex, and all their energy goes into making spores and making reproductive cells.
Larry, the other
strategy is like morels, which grow on a tree root, and they live for 100 years, and they just throw up a few babies every year.
Wow. Yeah, don't destroy those mushrooms. Leave them when you walk in the forest. Many people have the inclination to want to kick them. Anyway, we're right out of time. We're so privileged to have you on our show. Give us your webpage and interest people in your wonderful studies.
Carl, thank you for the time. My website again is www.fungaljungle.org. Fungaljungle.org.
Thank you, and we'll be playing one of your songs on one of our in the next few weeks. Thank you for being
wonderful,
on Animal.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Larry. And
Thank you, Carl. Have a good day.
Thank you, Larry. And yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio. And we have a little CD that Alan's going to play. I hope we got enough time for that three minutes or so.
Where this CD piece you want to play is over 7 minutes long. Ooh. And I'm afraid we don't have that much time left in the show. So we can play. This is, I should say, what Carl has brought in is this great CD of bird songs by John Neville. John Neville is a local ornithologist who's done a great job over the years recording birds, and has produced a number of CDs, and this is a recent one called The Beginner's Guide to BC Birdsong. It's great. It's a two CD thing that is kind of an introductory, and it involves teaching you about bird songs and so on, and it's very good. But we don't have time for the introduction. We can play some of the songs if you'd like, but unfortunately, in the time available, it's already 12:54, and so there isn't time for a 7-minute piece. So if you'd like, we can play one or two of these, and then we'll just have to wrap up the show anyway.
Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you.
Get it going there. So we've been speaking with Larry Whitson. Have you got it on?
Whenever you're ready.
Okay, ready. Go ahead.
Conkeree. Or conkeree is the sound of a male red-winged blackbird in the cattails. Here are typical calls, whistled notes, and some check sounds from a marsh in the Bulkley Valley. The whistled notes differ in some regions, like these birds from Dawson Creek. The whistle has become a mechanical clink, rather like the sound made by a blacksmith's hammer on an anvil. When a female redwing enters or leaves a male territory, she makes this trilling sound. Thank you.
The song of the alder flycatcher, which is indistinguishable by sight from the willow flycatcher, even by experts, is a low, short, and quite raucous three-bear. Although their territories do overlap in some areas, generally, alder flycatchers are found in the northern two-thirds of the province, and the willow flycatcher in the southern third.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices, and I remember people that this coming week there's going to be a showing of Earthlings at the University of British Columbia. I believe it's next Thursday. I don't have the reference there. UBC people should go and see that wonderful documentary. Yes, and Captain Paul Watson, he said, the meat industry is the most destructive ecological industries on the planet. Is one of the most destructive. The raising and slaughtering of pigs, cows, sheep, and turkeys and chickens not only utilizes vast areas of land and vast quantities of water, but it is a greater distributor to greenhouse gas emissions than the automobile industry. Well, he hasn't very much kinder things to say about the seafood industry, which is literally plundering the ocean of life, and some 50% of fish caught from the oceans is fed to cows, pigs, sheep, chickens, etc., in the form of fish meal. It also takes about 50 fish caught from the sea to raise one farm-raised salmon. That's from Captain Paul Watson and his good ship. Well, we thank you for listening to Animal Voices. Our webpage is animalvoices.org, and many of our programs are posted right there. Bye for now.